Hello, welcome to Growing Wild. I am Charlotte Petz and this is Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online and on digital. On today's show we have Ruth Allen talking about her expedition across Bosnia. We have Joe Minahane talking about his book Floating. And finally, our resident gardener, Sophie Eliadis, tells us a little bit about her summer in the garden this year. First of all, let's have a song, and it's Fleetwood Mac and Go Your Own Way. Go Your Own Way by Fleetwood Mac. I saw a documentary with those guys a couple of weeks ago and they were just mad. I mean, they're all writing horrible songs about each other whilst going out with each other and then all having to sing them knowing that it was about them. Yeah, pretty mad. Okay, so first up we have Ruth Allen. So Ruth's one of those people that is many things, but in summary, she is a psychotherapist and she specialises in outdoor therapy, and she's also a writer. And she is about to embark on a solo trip across Bosnia, running hundreds of kilometres over a couple of weeks. I just thought she just seemed like a very interesting person. So I caught up with her and I started off by asking how she came to find herself doing the kind of work that she does.
Yeah, I basically came to it from my own realisation of how important the outdoors was for me. So I used to work with rocks, really. I didn't work with people. I was, my background is geology.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They don't talk back.
Yeah. It's a dream.
And it, you know, that was great, and that sort of cultivated my deepened my love, I suppose, for the mountains. I ended up getting into geology and pursuing that because I wanted almost a passport to the mountains. And that was great, and it sort of satisfied that itch, if you like. But it wasn't enough in terms of, it was rocks rather than people. And so I started to do voluntary work for the Samaritans, and I got interested in mental health stuff and well-being and crisis support and that sort of thing. And so over the years, I guess I've just try to cultivate the different interests that I have, and at some point I thought, you know, there's a real gap for using the outdoors more in supporting people in their mental health and well-being. So that's when I decided I was going to retrain as a psychotherapist, as counsellor, and then try and create a pathway into outdoor therapy, because there isn't really a set route in. It's you know, there's lots of sort of professional development courses, and there's increasingly more books on it, and there's more articles being published on the sort of the nature well-being benefits, but there isn't really a way in. So the story of the last few years of my life is really just kind of creating a space to talk about it, and then if people relate to that and they think that's something I want, then we can do that, and we create something in line with what they need. So it's quite fluid at the moment.
Yeah, you're kind of creating your own map for it in a way, because it's not a very charted ground, is it? It's quite a new.
There are people that it is being done, and it's an ancient tradition. Really,
well, yeah, exactly. That's the ironic thing, isn't it? We've taken it out from being, we were just so much more in nature all of the time, and we were connected in such a different way. And then we've removed ourselves from that, and now it's finding our way back again.
Definitely. And, you know, there's a long history of things like shamanism. And, you know, so the whole concept of nature being important for our health, I mean, it used to be so much more important, but there were those kind of centuries or decades where things went missing. And so, yeah, it's bringing something fairly old back into our kind of modern consciousness, I think, but in a way that suits us now, that kind of honours the fact that we don't live those more tribal lives anymore. So how do we reinvent that for the present, if you like? And I think that's a lot of my preoccupation, is how do we help people realise that this is relevant for their lives now? It's not a fringe subject. It's not something that's a bit woo, you know. It's it's really important, and you know, there's a lot of benefit that anyone can get, and that's not about athleticism, it's not about fitness, it's about engaging in relationship, I suppose.
So that leads me on to your next adventure, which is in Bosnia, because you've been quite clear on saying it's not about my athleticism, or it's more for the experience. And well, can you tell me a bit more about the trip, what you're going to be doing, and why?
I ask myself why every day. Every morning I wake up with kind of sweats thinking, why did I think this was a good idea? No, I'm really excited. So I'm going to be running across Bosnia-Herzegovina from the Croatian border to the Montenegrin border, and that's about 350 kilometers through the mountains. And it came about because I'd wanted to, well, I thought about walking it. I was going to just kind of treat myself to 2 weeks of going on every now and every other year. I like to do a big trip on my own, a kind of a chance to embrace solitude and just sort of push myself a bit. So I kind of do this every other year as a bit of a bigger trip. So I decided I was going to do this. But then I had this kind of thought, why don't I run it? And once I'd had the thought, I was kind of beholden.
You're in trouble.
And it was really hard, because on the one hand I thought, wow, wouldn't that be something for me to do, and on the other hand I was like, you know, I can't do it. And it was a real wrench, and with this the thoughts flooded in, if you like, around, you know, I'm not the kind of person that can do this. This isn't what people like me do. And you know, I was like, what? I was just curious about what's that about? You know, what's this idea that there is a type of person, that an adventurer is a type of person, that you have to fit a certain image, that you have to talk in a certain way, that you have to be fearless. And I kind of wanted just to throw open the window on that and say, you know, you can be adventurous in many different ways, and they're made, not born. And you know, a lot of the time you read adventurers books and they talk about the struggle afterwards in their best-selling book, and I wanted to talk about that before and just say, actually, this does terrify me.
Someone expressing fear and worry about something, it somehow makes it a relatable experience, because we all have those feelings. A lot of people don't say that they do, and so you think, oh, you have, like you said, you have to be a certain sort of person to be able to do those things. But you're kind of showing that actually, if you have the idea and you've got the courage to do it, then anyone can, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have been absolutely plagued by kind of problems this summer, starting and ending, really, with the heat wave.
It's been boiling. How do you run in that?
I know, it was great in so many ways, but I'm sort of fair-skinned. I've got, you know, ginger hair. I am the classic burn type, you know, and I do kind of get overwhelmed with anything above about 22 degrees. So it's been interesting to try and fit the training in. And obviously when that then slips, then that self-doubt and punishment comes in. And, you know, again, I'm not the kind of person. Why did I think I could do this? So in some ways I have been tested to the max in the way that I suppose I needed to be, and to still prove that I could, you know, walk the walk or run the run or whatever.
So tell me a bit about what the training entails.
I'm the first person to kind of try and Google, like, you know, how do you prepare for this kind of multi-day trip? Because everything you find is like multi-day stage races or long distance walks. And what I'm doing is very much a hybrid. Like, I'm trying to strip out this idea that that something is only worthwhile if it's the fastest, if it's the longest, if it's the, you know, blah, blah, blah. I have just been trying to, I suppose, spend as much time on my feet as possible, just running every day as much as possible, and just gradually filling up a backpack and running with that. But you know, I've kind of got to the point that I'm going to get fit by doing it. I think my biggest challenge will be the mental kind of getting up every day and thinking, right, I've got to run that again, and then run that again, and run that again.
What sort of distance are you needing to cover every day?
Worst case scenario is that it's just what I could walk in a day. And so you know, I'm kind of allowing myself 2 weeks, which is a huge amount of time. That's only really looking at sort of 30 kilometers a day. So, but that's going to allow me to run. And then when I get to where I am, I can pitch my tent, I can do the writing that I want to do. So I'm planning on doing a lot of writing while I'm away. I'm going to be able to go and, you know, try and meet some locals and gather my food together from somewhere and make my fires, that sort of thing. So because I don't want to be harassed by having to do, you know, 70 kilometers a day and then somehow need to survive at the end of each day. This is not supposed to be a punishment. It's supposed to be a chance to, you know, revel and take glory in nature for 2 weeks.
Yeah, rather than not to cry and, and weep every day and think, why?
And
this is the biggest trip you've done so far. You mentioned that you've done other things. You kind of do it maybe on every other year that you'll do something. What sort of other trips have you done?
Yeah, so I did like an alpine crossing. I did the Haute route by myself a couple of years ago, but that was very much hut to hut. That was in France and Switzerland, but that was mountain hut to mountain hut. So I had only a 30 litre pack then, but it didn't have to have a sleeping bag in it.
Yeah,
didn't need cooking stuff, didn't need a tent. And so stuff like that. And I've done other solo trips. I spent a few weeks in Italy and a few weeks in Iceland. And so,
and what do you get from doing that? What's your experience been from doing that by yourself, and why are you drawn to do that?
I think because it's a really good question, and it's really kind of a complex one in a way. I could probably ramble forever, and I'll try not to. But
I've got the power of the edit, so okay. For your one-word answer.
I think in some ways, I mean, it's all that classic stuff around, you know, how, you know, solitude and time out is good for you. But I think more than that, it's, for me, it's been important since I've been married, to go out and do stuff by myself, because I think, and this wasn't a particular issue that was actually happening, but I what I didn't want to happen was that I just became somebody in a pair, that the only time we did stuff was together. And my husband travels for work as well, and I was very keen when we met and before we got married to preserve my sense of selfhood and self-reliance and being able to depend on myself if I needed to. And I think sometimes that just slips, you know, and it's lovely when you're with someone and you depend on each other, and that these are all great things. But then I think it's, for me, it's important to remind myself I'm capable as my own woman, as my own person in the world as well. And I get forced into that, if you like, being in the wild somewhere. and to make that conscious decision to say, you know, we have our trips together and we have our life together, but there's also things I need to do for myself, and things I need to experience and put myself through. that I think is just really important for my well-being, for my own sense of mental health, for knowing that, you know, I can face stuff, and it's not I can just face stuff in the wild. It's I can face stuff if the worst happens in other scenarios, if I ever find myself on my own, or do you know what I mean?
It's self-trust, isn't it? It's developing a real sense of self-reliance and self-trust, would you say?
Yeah, that's a lot more succinct and elegant way of putting it.
So when is the trip?
So I fly out on the 18th of September, Tuesday the 18th, yeah, and I will start the run the next day. So I have the first night in Sarajevo just to, you know, get my camping fuel and get my money and get my wits about me, that sort of thing.
Yeah, your bearings.
And then I'm going to do the run, and then I'm going to see how much time I have left over at the end, and then I'm due to fly back on the 4th of October. So that's kind of my final, that's the point where I have to be back in Sarajevo. But what happens in between is kind of free flowing at the moment. I'm going to see how much I can do and just run until I can't, and then walk a bit.
What an inspiring lady. I just think that's such a cool trip. It's the sort of thing that I want to be able to get to do as well. You know, I've done such miniature versions of things compared to that. And hearing that, I just found it just super inspiring. You can find out more about Ruth at whitepeakwellbeing.com. And I'm hoping actually to catch up with her afterwards and see how it went. I'm really intrigued to know how the whole trip went. And she's hoping to put together some kind of book or writings while she's out there. So keep an eye out for that. After this next song, we're going to be talking to Joe Minahan, who also uses the outdoors and connects it to mental health. He's going to be talking to us about his book. But first off, let's have a song, and it's Hit the Road, Jack by Ray Charles.
I guess if you say so, I'll have to pack my things and go.
Short but sweet, isn't it, that? Hit the Road, Jack by Ray Charles. Okay, so Joe Minahan, he has written a book called Floating, A Life Regained. It's actually been out for quite a while now, but a few months back I went to the book launch, the paperback book launch, and ever since I've wanted to get him on the show. His book's about wild swimming and his discovery of it and how it's helped him with his experiences of anxiety. He's recently just brought out a video, and it's sort of a 8-minute version of the book, I suppose. But it's a really beautiful video. I'll put a link to it on the show page, on the Growing Wild show page on RadioReverb.com. So I caught up with him on the seafront, and it was that thing where, you know, it's been such good weather for such a long time, I sort of forgot that it can get super windy down there. So we're in one of those seats that were sheltered. So it sounds a little bit like we're in a public loo, but I can promise you we're not. We are on the seafront. This is me just asking him a little bit more about the book and how he came to write it.
I started going swimming quite a lot at Hampstead Ponds when I was living in London, and at the Mixed Ponds. My wife and I went up there on a really hot day, and we lived in South London. We're like, come on, we'll go to the ponds. We've never been there before. I wasn't particularly keen, to be perfectly honest. But as soon as I got in, I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed like the sort of convivial sense of like everybody doing something fairly primal, a bit daft, in a place where you know, getting in a pond is a bit of a weird thing to do. I just really liked the sense that I could be in my own bubble fairly quickly. There were a lot of people around having a similar sort of experience, but I wasn't prepared for how good it would make me feel, how calm it would make me feel afterwards. I don't know if you've ever swum at the ponds, but there's no like shallow area. You don't sort of wade out. You're just straight in. You either jump in off the jetty or you lower yourself in off the metal rung, which is what I did first time. And like the first time you do that, it's like, and then like
your feet, I know that feeling.
Yeah, and then there's like the foot groping for the bottom rung, and then it's not there anymore. So you've got to go.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. Like, you know, and I think that sort of set me off on this. Perhaps I hadn't. Definitely had anxiety then. Perhaps I hadn't labelled it. Well, I hadn't labelled it. I didn't really understand what was going on. I'd been a freelance journalist at that point for about a year and a half, 2 years, and I didn't necessarily like. That's what I'd always wanted to do. It's what I'd always wanted to be. It's what I still like doing. But I think I had this idea in my mind that I had to spend all my time at home alone, working. But really working was just staring at a screen, getting more and more stressed and very anxious, and then like very, very isolated, which then obviously leads to depression. So like it's this sort of knock-on effect of everything. So when I started going swimming, that was a good way of A, getting me out of the house to do something that wasn't work, and B, finding a way to help me feel calm. So when I came back, I actually felt geared up to do things, to do work. And then it sort of snowballed, and I was looking for something that wasn't writing about phones or TVs or like Bluetooth headsets. You know, tech journalism is still a thing, and it's still a thing I do for money, but it's not something I particularly saw myself doing just solely for the rest of my life. And so I just came up with this idea that's like, right, I'd started reading Waterlogged by Roger Deakin when I'd taken up the swims. This was after I picked up Kate Rue's Wild Swim book, the guidebook, and that's, I think it was recommended reading in back of Kate's book. So I was like, right, you know, I'm going to read this. And that sort of came to it, that through Kate's book and then through Rob McFarlane's Wild Places, because there's a whole section of him and Deakin going off on these sort of madcap trips together. I just liked the sound of Roger Deakin. He just sounded a bit nuts, and like he ploughed his own furrow, which is not who I am at all. So I was like, right, I'm going to do this, I'm going to make this happen. It was a bit haphazard, really. Deakin had a very set way of doing things. Like, you know, he wanted to start the Isles of Scilly because he thought it was going to be warmer down there in April. He was wrong. But then sort of worked his way up through the country with a few sort of offshoots, and he'd always go back to Suffolk, to his home, a moat that was around his farmhouse, as you do. Mm-hmm. He swam in there every day. And so I started out in London because that was where I knew. So the trip just snowballed, really. It got really out of control very quickly.
How many swims was it?
I think it's like 77.
And how much time did you have to do that? Or did you allot yourself?
I initially allotted myself a year because Deakin had taken like 9 months.
Okay.
But like,
Deakin
didn't work. Deakin was a man in his 50s. He was notionally retired.
He had a moat.
He was a baby boomer, so obviously, like, you know, money wasn't an issue.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't live in South London. He wasn't paying egregious amounts of rent. He wasn't, you know, he didn't have to, you know, work in the sense, you know, he was working as a filmmaker or whatever, but he didn't have to work in the sense that he needed loads of money to survive. And, and he was able to take that time. And so it took me about, for the first year, I started in the August, which was a bit daft because I'd never swum through the winter before. So it got to October, ooh, and I was like, look at this. And I borrowed a wetsuit and did a couple of swims with that. But I didn't hugely enjoy swimming with a wetsuit on. I mean, I like the fact that you can swim for longer in the colder water. You can enjoy being in the sea.
It's not really swimming, though, is it? It's sort of a bit more dunky, splashy, get out kind of.
Yeah,
even with a wetsuit.
Yeah, it's not like I think Deakin always refers to himself as a jotter rather than a writer. I refer to myself as a dipper rather than a swimmer. Like,
okay.
I'm not the guy who's going to swim. I mean, we're on Brighton Seafront, you know, and I have a few friends who do the pull to pier and like swim between piers, like bow down to them. I can swim that far, but like I get a little bit, like that's not really what I'm in it for, almost. Yeah. I think the mental health benefits are perhaps more important to me than the physical ones. I mean, my technique isn't great. I'm self-taught, and I know that if I were to go to certain teachers, they'd look at my technique and shudder. And it does
improve. Well, if you could get from one place to another.
Hey, look, I can get from A to B without my neck hurting. I think that's fine.
That's
all
right.
I'm okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, sort of a year into it, it had become a bit of a tick box exercise, and I had like a spreadsheet of swims, and I write a lot about this, and it just became not joyless, but it was just like go to a place, get in, come out, and it's like, right, okay, I can mark that green on the spreadsheet. And then
so you kind of turned something that was helpful and a release into a job and a task.
I'm very, very good at turning fun things into onerous things. So that around that time I had a run in with a car while I was on my bike in South London. I broke my wrist, and sort of, well, obviously it meant I couldn't swim for like a couple of 3 months, but it kind of made me reassess where I was at emotionally, which wasn't a very good place. And that was the point where I was like, well, I can't swim, so I'm not going to be able to like go and do the thing that helps, and I'm pretty bad like anxiety wise and so that was when I decided that like therapy was going to be the way to go. He talks a lot about this idea of floating and like being in the scene again, something taps into the swimming, so like bobbing around and like just not, I had this tendency that he always said was to line my ducks up in a row and then nail those ducks down. It's like, well, that's not life, you know, you need to be within it, just letting everything going on around you. Like, you can't, I suppose not too strong to call me a control freak, and you know, that is what I am and still am, but I think it was just trying to unlearn those habits, which is very hard and is an ongoing process. I suppose it's what therapists call the work, and you have to do the work, otherwise you don't unlearn those habits. But what I found was when I started going swimming again, while I was still having therapy, once my cast came off, I just was really enjoying the swims for what they were. And so that was around that point that the blog was starting to form in my head into this idea of a book. And then when that was done, showing it to an editor who was like, you've got to be more honest, you've got to be more open. Like, oh god. And so I took myself away right at the end. I think I was still, no, I'd finished by that point. I think this was just after I'd finished, and after I finished the journey, and I took myself away to my Regis and Dorset on my own for a week. which wasn't great for my mental health, I'll be honest. It's quite a weird place to be. Like, I love Lyme, it's where I go on family holidays, I love swimming there. So I'd go and swim in the mornings, then I'd have coffee, and then I'd take myself to like this room in a cottage that I'd rented. I'd just write, and it was quite hard because it was like, right, this is all the stuff that you have to face up to and you have to be honest about. But I wrote like 20,000 words in 4 days. Wow. And it was just this like, complete release, and it just was all just pouring out. And funnily enough, I was, when we were when a few weeks ago I was going through some notebooks, and I found the notebook from that week, and I was like jotting down the word count and then jotting down what I was going to put down, and it was nuts. And it got done very quickly, and I think that was basically it. It didn't, after that, don't feel like it needed a horrendous amount of work. There were line edits, but it was done, and it came very quickly. And I think once it was all out, it felt that the release was amazing. Although then there was the weird thing of going for swims and not writing about it. So you get in, and I went up to Norfolk to see everyone after I'd done it, and I was like, look, I've got the manuscript, like, it's here, it's huge, look at it, I've done. And so what I'd always do when I went up to Norfolk, I'd go, and I'd generally just for a day, and you know, just when I was living in London, and come back in the evening, and I'd spend like the train journey, I would write up notes, and I'd go through photos, and I'd like, you know, get everything together because I was going to write a blog post about it. And I remember the first one I came back, and I was just like, what do I do now? Like, this is like, who am I?
It's my focus.
Yeah, what is my focus? And I'm still not, you know, there are various projects in the works, but you know, that's a long time ago, and I've still not quite sussed that out.
Yeah,
but that's fine.
That's
normal,
isn't it? I think,
yeah.
Especially when it's something that surged up so naturally, and it was so in line with that part of your life.
Yeah,
I mean, that doesn't happen very often.
No, it was quite serendipitous, and I think that's quite hard to. That project, yeah, it was a very organic. I don't always like using that term, but it's very true. It was a very organic thing, and trying to I've got a couple of ideas for something else that I want to do about mental health and the outdoors, but I feel like I'm trying to force it a little bit.
Do you think being that much more honest? That your editor went, I think I told you, you have to go away and be more honest. Do you think that's what people have connected with more than just somebody retelling a story?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
So
as much as it's quite, you know, vulnerable and revealing to do that, it's actually what connects us.
It's the thing that I get the most reaction to. It's the thing that people contact me most about. And I still don't find that particularly easy. Like you say, it's quite a vulnerable place to be. I still find it like oddly embarrassing, which I know I shouldn't do, but you know, like, it's quite it's something that's obviously touched a lot of people, and I really like that, and I'm really appreciative of that. And I think what's interesting, I mean, what I have noticed is when I do a lot of readings and events, that the people who talk to me about that are always women. Very, very rarely, in fact, never, I don't think, has a man come up to me after an event and said, I can really relate to this. And that makes me... But obviously, it's amazing that those people who come to me and speak to me about that do that. They've been very open with someone who they don't know. That's great. But I do kind of feel like this is an issue that... Men speak to me on social media about it.
Interesting, yeah.
But not in real life.
Not in real life.
No.
There lies the problem.
It's a massive issue.
Yeah.
And it is really telling that... You know, men don't want to talk about it. Men find it embarrassing for lots of reasons. For, you know, for the times we live in, it's toxic. There's a lot of toxic masculinity about. I know that's a term that's bandied about, but it's true.
It's
a thing.
True,
it exists, and there's shame attached to it still. I think it's just a chronic lack of understanding of what mental health problems are. There's this idea that you're really, really unwell or you're fine. There's no like grading of it. You know, like when you're physically ill, you might have a cold, you might have the flu, or you might have cancer.
Yeah.
Like, you know, they're not the same. Those are all physical ailments, you know what I mean? It's not, but like, I wouldn't term my anxiety as like so severe that I couldn't live my life. I certainly wasn't suicidal, but that at the same time, there are people who do feel like that. Yeah, and I think it's this understanding that actually with a lot of these things, you end up, you sort of live with them. You don't, you know, someone said to me, oh, do you just swim alongside it? I'm like, yeah, really? Like, you know, there are weeks when I'm in a mess.
Yeah.
But the fact is, I know what it is now. So, like, you know, I know how to deal with it. It's just recognising when those coping mechanisms are coming in. Like, my wife's very good at saying, you need to go for a swim now.
It's not that you found a cure-all for... Mm-hmm. anxiety, but you found something that helps you, that has led to this incredible project.
Yes.
So where do you want it to go next, do you know?
I feel like I've lived with this project now. It's 6 years since I did the first film. So it's a long time.
Yeah.
And what I really want to write another book. And I really want to carve the time out to write another book. As long as they spark conversations, and if it means people are more honest, then great. That's all you can ever hope for these kind of things. And the reaction to that has been phenomenal. Like, you know, people just saying, you know, the honesty has really helped, and they really respect that. And that's all I can really ask for, to be perfectly honest.
I think that's such a wonderful point, that the more honest you are, the more people connect with it, and hopefully the more it can help. I think it's great the way that just opens out the conversation. And again, this theme just comes up over and over again, and of how being in nature, it may not be a cure-all, it may not be a forever thing, but it's certainly a salve, and just how people really do benefit from engaging and immersing in nature. And, you know, I enjoy talking to these people because I've had similar experiences, and I know it's just helped me enormously. His book is well worth a read, and you can find out more about him on jmtravels.org, and again I'll put all of that on the Growing Wild show page on radioreverb.com. Okay, so let's have a song, and then we're going to hear from our old mucker Sophie Eliadis, and just to see how she's gotten in her garden. But first let's have Aretha Franklin and I Say a Little Prayer. The late and magnificent Aretha Franklin. This is Growing Wild. I am Charlotte Petz, and you are listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM. Okay, so last up we have Sophie Eliadis. Any regular listeners out there will recognise the name, and she does pop up fairly frequently. Usually around autumn, we realised. Last time we caught up with her, I was on her allotment, and we did a tour of her allotment. You know, the air raid shelter and the compost area. So I just thought we'd have a little catch up because it's been quite an unusual year in the garden, and just to see how her plot's doing. And so after a fairly lengthy chat about the merits of cornflakes and why Brighton don't recycle Tetra Paks, I got on to asking her how her plot is doing. How's the allotment?
Yes, it's looking really good. It went through a bit of a phase of struggling over the summer. It was very dry, and although it meant that we didn't have to do any weeding, which was really nice, it did mean that the, you know, things were kind of exhausted pretty quickly. Things like the French beans and stuff, we really only had one lot. I mean, we had a few weeks of picking, but I think they probably would have had a longer season, but it was just so tiring for them.
The hot weather really affected everyone, I think.
Yeah.
You know, most people have had a terrible year of just stuff didn't grow, or if it did, it was piddly. My sweet corn's a disaster. I mean, it's just out like a fart of a sweet corn kernel.
Yeah, it's nothing, is it? And
no.
I mean, the only thing that's done really well, and I think that's because they start out so vigorous and then they kind of slow off anyway, is all the pumpkins and squashes. They look really good, but they're still growing now, so that's, you know, they've just managed to hold it together until the cool weather came, and now they're just kind of like, oh, okay. But yeah, no, honestly, we had the beans were a real disaster. What else was awful? Well, just all the cabbages and things. Also, you just can't, you know, you just can't quite imagine that you're ever going to want to eat a cabbage when it's, you know, 30 degrees and you can't water anything. You know, you just think, I don't want to eat a cabbage. I don't even want to think about a cabbage.
Exactly, you feel angry towards the cabbages.
Yeah, I got really fed up with them, and I was like, oh, you're just covered in green fly, and it was just really like disheartening at sometimes. But things like beetroot, just merrily get on with it. You know, they don't care. So we've had a lot of beetroot. We've had a lot of root crops. Good carrots. Parsnips are looking really good. We did some celeriac this year, which is the first year, and that's looking really good.
Yeah, raspberries did very well this year.
Yes, actually, surprisingly, soft fruit have done better than expected, I think, because I think you know, with it being so hot for so long, or hot, so dry for so long, I think people thought that soft fruit would be very small and kind of very seedy.
Yes.
But actually, it seems to they've seemed to have somehow miraculously found a enough water to really be plump. And they're really delicious as well. I've had some fantastic blackberries this year as well, and they've been, you know, again, you think nobody waters blackberries, do they?
So no.
You think that, they'd have been really small, but no, they've been really good.
It's turned so many things upside down for me. It's like a world that doesn't make sense anymore.
It is a world that doesn't make sense. It's been really strange, hasn't it? And then now we are absolutely, you know, it's like we have got to work every day that we've got to get the weeds down because they're just growing so fast.
Yeah.
Everything is just, you know, a bit of
it's got
a
so much rain. So much warmth in the soil now.
Yeah.
It's retained so much heat and just that little bit of water, everything goes crazy. So, yes.
And all those...
Go on.
Oh, sorry.
No, go on.
I was just saying that all the seeds that were, you know, that were released in, you know, the beginning of May or beginning of June, that just sat there all through the summer. Normally you'd have them kind of germinating and growing and then germinating and you'd be picking them, and now suddenly they're all germinating now, which means you've got like 3 months worth of weed seeds in, you know, 1 week or 2 weeks. It's crazy.
Oh no, I need to go to my allotment and check out the situation. I've just been sort of going up there and grazing raspberries and then going, okay,
yeah,
bye.
Nice, yeah, I do that. I just sort of wander around.
Yeah,
and see,
pick some fruit. That'll do. That looks all right.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm not sure I'm going to get away with that for much longer. How has it affected your other work? Have you found that you haven't really had much to do?
I did have quite a bit of sort of time off and days off and things over the very hot period, especially in sort of middle of July. It was just, I mean, I didn't really want to be at work, to be honest.
So me either.
I mean, I'm sure there were things to do, but I didn't, I was very cautious about everything. I didn't want to cut, you know, usually in July you can do a sort of shrub trim, you can cut things down, you can even do water branch pruning on apple trees and things like that, but you can't do that if it's so hot that you might damage, you know, that the plant isn't going to be able to replenish itself. Even geraniums, you know, normally I cut them back, you know, once the sort of main bulk of flowers is finished, you cut them right back and they have another go. But I was just being really super conservative with a small c.
Turned into a Tory.
Yeah.
In the summer.
Yeah. Brexit. So I just put a load of posters up. but yeah, I was just being really careful because I didn't think anything had the, you know, had the resources, and a lot of things have died. You know, things have literally
just given up the goat. They've just like huge rosemary bushes have just dusted.
Yes.
It was like, oh yes. No, and that was
that's
yeah,
true.
Oh.
Rosemary has really taken a battering. I've seen a few rosemaries. You know what? Rosemaries have really hated this year. I think I've seen a few where they hated that snow. They hated the wet in the early spring. They didn't really recover, and then they got totally, like, frazzled.
Yeah, and they're just livid. Yeah. Like, oh, this is enough for me.
They're like, right, that's it. Becoming a tumbleweed. I'm leaving. Up my roots and wander off.
See you later. It's not just me. It's my mate over there and my mate down there. We've all had a chat.
They're all leaving. Yeah.
See you later.
We're striking.
Coming back to time.
Yeah, mass exodus of the woody herbs.
So what do you think is next? Because it has been such an unusual year, and it's only just tailing off now. I think last year, the temperatures we have now, we were like peak summer, and we were all like, "Whoa, it's boiling!" And, you know, kind of thinking...
Whereas now I'm...
Like, now everyone's in... Yeah, got the heating on, got nine jumpers on, you know, you've turned into your annoying friend that comes back from Cyprus or whatever and says, like, oh, gosh, it's just so cold here. And you're like, shut up. But,
yeah, you've been in Cyprus for a week.
Exactly. No, you're not jet lagged, and you've got the accent. Stop eating olive oil, and it's not that cold. We've all turned it, like literally the whole country has turned into that person. It's quite funny.
Yeah, exactly.
So garden wise.
Well, I actually am quite enjoying it now because it's cooled right down. The soil's really nice and moist and workable. But there's still enough heat, like you said, there's still enough heat in the soil to get things growing. So you've actually got time now to catch up a bit. So I've been doing a lot of sort of pruning, shrubs back. I've been the wisteria, that really needs doing now. I normally do it at the beginning of August, but it just was too dry. So I've noticed in the last 3 or 4 weeks, things have really, like, the wisteria has just absolutely rocketed off. All those sorts of climbers that you can trim that are, you know, some of the clematis as well, you can do them now. You can really actually, it's quite a good time to kind of really shape the garden again, because it's not going to have time before it cools right down to kind of completely get out of hand. But you can really give shrubs and sort of woody things a bit of a shape, because you've got plenty of warmth and plenty of moisture to kind of help them regrow, so they're not going to be bare for the winter. But yeah, I think that's one of the things I'm doing at the moment, and also things like turning the compost and just getting back in control a bit, because I just had to sort of leave it to its own devices for a while. Yesterday I just spent the whole day on my hands and knees just weeding, and it was lovely. You know, it was really nice. The soil's really sort of loose and soft, and you can get everything out and you get the roots out, and you know, you don't feel like you're just snapping everything off or, you know, digging in a car park. It's like it's really nice. It was lovely. I was just, you know, under the tree and things like that. It was really good, picking up all the windfalls, and you know, it's really good. It's a lovely autumn, actually. We're going to have a really nice, I'm sure the colours are going to be really good as well. You know, the trees are going to have plenty of sunlight to do exciting colours.
How's the air raid shelter? Still standing?
Good. Yeah, still standing.
You put your microwave in yet?
No, a solar powered microwave. Yeah, it's looking good. It needs a bit of a tidy up. I think it's always this time of year, you've just kind of start chucking stuff from the door, you know, it becomes like a skip. But that's why I love winter, because that's when you can kind of take everything out and sort through it all and clean it out. And yeah, it's just not, it's not looking its best, but it is at least standing. Greenhouse is looking good. A lot of things fell off the hooks in the greenhouse because they got so heavy. So the tomatoes, we had 3 different tomatoes fall and snap, but actually not completely break. And tomatoes are so amazing that we just pulled them back up and taped around the stems, and it never happened. Preserving stuff, if you've got allotments, you can start, you know, picking things and preserving them for the winter. You can kind of imagine it now, like I was saying, you know, you can't imagine wanting to eat a cabbage in
40 degree heat.
Yeah, but now I'm starting to think, oh yeah, actually, you know, sauerkraut for Christmas and
nice little chutney,
pickles, yeah, chutneys. You know, I've got a dehydrator, so I'm doing all my dried fruits now, and sun-dried tomatoes. You know, any tomato that gets a bit wrinkly or splits or something that isn't going to store well, then I just stick it in the dehydrator and whack it in a bit of olive oil at the end.
Do you think we'll ever have another year like this? I mean, is this going to be the future? Or is this just been some crazy anomaly like 1976?
Yeah, it's just an anomaly. Yeah, it's just one of those years, isn't it? They go like this sometimes. We had one of these, a similar year in 2003, I think, where it was very hot for quite a long time. Or it wasn't actually as hot as it was, but it didn't rain for a long time. People are very quick to forget things. It was really lovely, though, wasn't it? You know, it was so nice, you know, living in Brighton, it was so nice being able to just know that you could go, look, let's go to the beach and have a swim, and you could do it, because there was no question about whether the weather was going to be good.
Yeah, and whereas, it was a mill pond out there. Summers. The water was so still for weeks and weeks. I took it for granted, actually, and then we've had a week of it being a bit more leery, and it's like, oh, I can't just get in the sea whenever I want.
Exactly, you can't just strip off and go in. Yeah,
yeah.
You have to sort of think, well, we'll look at the forecast. And in fact, that's the funny thing, is since it started raining again, I've just been like obsessively looking at the forecast, because I'm so enjoying the changes. I'm like, oh, tomorrow it's going to be windy. Oh, Wednesday's going to be warm but cold. Thursday's going to be raining but really hot. So I've just started, you know, I've gotten back into my British obsession with the BBC weather forecast.
I think my favourite thing is when you're outside and you look up and you go, oh, weather looks weird, and then you check the app. I'm not going to use my own eyes. I'm just going to look at the app. Well, the app says that it is actually raining, and it's like, well, the app says it's not meant to rain. No, so I love it. Something's wrong. And it's the real weather that's wrong.
But the other day I was like, raincoat and shorts, which I was like, that's like, you know, I feel like a postman. Classic August weather, raincoat, t-shirt, sweating, raincoat, shorts, boots.
Yeah, I hear you. That's my favourite look, actually. I love it. I just had to end that conversation somewhere because we do go on, and I thought, you know, looking like a postman, that's a good ending. It's always great to catch up with Sophie. She is actually also a therapist, so she uses She does both gardening and therapy. So again, it's that kind of, it's that connection with nature that just seems to be so important. Okay, we're coming to the end of the show. I'm going to play you out with a couple of songs, but first of all, I just want to say thank you to everybody who was on, and do find out more about them on the Growing Wild show page on RadioReverb.com. You can get in touch with me on Instagram and Twitter at GrowingWildFM. You can email GrowingWildReverb@gmail.com, or you can find me through the Radio Reverb website. I'm going to play you out with Earth, Wind and Fire, September. Until next time, thanks for listening and go well.